Hi guys!
Welcome to Wicked, Weird, and Grand, your number one podcast for a trip through the history of the odd, haunting, and mystifying. I'm Caroline.
And I'm Aura. Together, we're the Grimm Sisters.
Hi, everyone.
Hi, guys.
Welcome to Wicked, Weird, and Grim, your number one podcast for a trip through the history of the odd, haunting, and mystifying. I'm Caroline.
And I'm Aura. Together, we're the Grimm Sisters. So in July, Caroline took a visit to one of the spookiest towns in America, Salem, Massachusetts, which brings us to our topic for today's episode, which is the Salem Witch Trials.
Visiting Salem was honestly a dream come true because I've dreamed of going there forever, and I can't believe I finally got to go. I definitely knew a lot about the witch trials going in just because I'm a history nerd and I love weird stuff, but there are a lot of things that I learned while I was there that I didn't know before, or things that, you know, where I'd heard conflicting versions of the story and I feel like I got a lot of clarity on them. There are also a lot of really pervasive myths around the Salem witch trials that really need to be dispelled, and there's just a lot about it that's not really widely understood. Hopefully we'll be able to dispel some of those things for you guys and shed some light on some things that you may not have known before.
I'm really excited.
Me too!
For so long, the Salem witch trials has just been something I'm endlessly fascinated in, not only because there's this entire pervasive history around it, but also because of the fact that we still, just like the last episode, don't really know what entirely caused this. Was it just Puritan girls having fun making up these things? Was it a somatoform disorder? What was it? And so it's kind of been a long time research interest and topic for me. I've just been so endlessly fascinated with it. I actually wrote an article for the UK magazine The Skeptic, and it is a magazine that explores pseudoscience, abnormal psychology, paranormal investigation, and kind of takes a more skeptical lens to these things. And I actually did an article on the Salem witch trials for them, and it was actually my thesis for my anomalistic psychology course when I was studying abroad. And so it was definitely a shock when they contacted me and were like, would you like to be published in our magazine? But it was so fun to write the thesis itself, and so I was really happy to have them publish it. From there, we will jump in and talk about Salem, Massachusetts.
Yes.
Yay.
In order to really understand what happened in Salem in 1692, we have to start talking about who the people living in Salem were.
Mm-hmm.
Who were they? What did they believe in? Why did they come to the New World? So it's really important to understand that they were Puritans. And for any of our American listeners in school, when you talked about the early Massachusetts colonies like Plymouth, Boston, Salem, etc., you probably learned the Pilgrims came to America in the 1600s and they were Puritans.
Mm-hmm.
You also may have learned that the Puritans came to the New World in search of quote-unquote religious freedom.
Yeah.
And that's the first myth that we really have to dispel. The Puritans wanted nothing to do with religious freedom
at all.
They were like the least supportive of religious freedom. And we won't get into this too much, but something that had happened in Europe prior to this was the Protestant Reformation. And in England, Henry VIII breaks away from the Catholic Church because he wants a divorce, and he starts the Anglican Church. So a lot of Protestants in England at the time, they're really happy about this. They're like, yes, finally, we're going to not be Catholic anymore. The Puritans were a group of Protestants who basically felt like the Anglican Church was still too similar to Catholicism.
Mm-hmm.
They felt like it was too ritualistic, too traditional, had a lot of like pomp and circumstance that they didn't like. And they wanted a church service that was really
bare bones.
Yeah, bare bones is really the way to explain it, I think. And so basically, they are called the Puritans because they literally wanted to purify the Anglican Church. This actually caused a lot of problems for them because they they were extremely radical in their way of doing things. Not only did they want to purify the church, but they also had really, really strict beliefs about everything in life. They were basically the most boring people ever. Or at least that's kind of how I like to describe them, because they were so boring. Their whole lives were very boring. They were also probably some of the most irritating people in history. Just for real. Like, they were so irritating. They kind of believed that all people were inherently sinful and that all were capable of committing any possible crime. So a child was as capable of committing a mass murder as an adult, which...
It's like they watched The Orphan and they ran with it.
This really colored their judgment of everything around them. They saw sin and evil everywhere that they looked. Just about anything fun could lead one down a dark path to doing horrible, sinful things. To them, things like the devil and demons were completely real and tangible. They really believed the threat of like demons and Satan and witchcraft were just everywhere all the time. They saw a lot of things that are very ridiculous as being dangerous or sinful. For example, they saw vanity of any kind as being sinful. So naturally, colorful clothing wasn't allowed. Their churches were, like Aura said, very bare bones. There was no stained glass. There were no religious murals on the ceilings. There was nothing golden or bronze or any kind of...
Just a building.
It was literally just a building, like a wooden building. A boring wooden building, because they were boring. The children were basically not given any sort of childhood. They were not supposed to focus on anything frivolous, like playing or pretending. They were instead just supposed to focus on doing chores, their schoolwork, the Bible, and God.
Very boring.
Very, very boring lives. And, you know, now we know that this kind of thing is actually really detrimental to children's well-being and growth.
It's imagination important. Is
like
so
play
important.
Is important. Imagination is important. All of these kind of things that they were denied is important for your well-being when you're growing up. The Puritans were so extreme that they actually banned Christmas because they felt like it was gaudy and frivolous and fun, basically.
That's just...
It's so weird. And so
like,
weird.
We're gonna ban Christmas.
There was actually a time in England where the Puritans actually did have control. They had executed the king, and Oliver Cromwell became the leader of England for the rest of his life, basically. And by the time he died, the English were just sick of all of the rules that they reinstated the monarchy and never went back to that.
They were like, please, can we have some morsels? Can we please have some fun?
Can we please have Christmas? Please. Like, can you imagine, like, England not having Christmas? Come on.
I just, like, it's weird. Crazy.
So weird. They kind of just lived these very serious, again, boring, focused, religious lives. So this journalist, H.L. Mencken, said that Puritanism is the haunting fear that someone somewhere may be happy.
Oh my God.
And I think that that's a really good description of the Puritans. These are the people that eventually immigrated or migrated to the New World. They kept all of their beliefs with them and in many ways were coming here to... practice their beliefs in a way where they could create the world that they wanted, right? They were not coming here to escape from persecution. They were the people that persecuted others. They were the people who saw witches everywhere. They were the people who saw sin everywhere. They were coming here so that they could live their little closed off, strict religious views in private. Away
from a little bubble.
Oh, yeah, a bubble. Naturally, this led Salem of the 1690s to be a really different place than Salem is today, because the Salem today is really lively and fun, and it's just full of life and freedom of expression. The Salem in the 1690s was literally the total opposite. Think the most opposite of that it could possibly be. Just very bleak, conformist, obsessively religious. Not only were the people of Salem terrified that demons and the devil were just right outside their door all the time, they also had a lot of very real things to be afraid of. The Puritans were colonizers. They came here and colonized land that was already occupied by Native Americans. And understandably, they had conflict with those Native Americans. Just a few decades prior to the witch trials, King Philip's War had gone on in this area, and it actually sent a lot of settlers fleeing out of their homes and into places like Salem. So a lot of the people who lived in Salem had really experienced a lot of horrifying things, regardless of the fact that they were colonizers, right? They still were traumatized like anyone would be by the things that they had seen and witnessed and by the fear that they experienced. They were also in a completely foreign land, you know, and that can be really scary. I mean, anybody who's ever lived in a place that's far away from their home and has done so kind of by themselves or without a lot of resources or friends that they know when they get there... it can be really scary even today when we have, you know, smartphones and cars and technology and a lot of safety. For them, there was basically, you know, no connection to England. They were very cut off from the society that they knew and had grown up in. And so for them, they were in a place where they didn't really know anything about the land. You know, they didn't know what was in the woods. They didn't know what was beyond the area that they had explored. And they're hearing all of these weird legends, or things that are weird to them anyway, from Native Americans. They're hearing these stories that to them don't really make sense. And so they're just having to interpret them however they can. They were also just completely dependent on like farming and trading. And so, you know, if crops failed, they were doomed. They were all going to die. They were going to starve to death. They were harsh people, but they were also in a really harsh, new, scary environment that had a lot of danger, very real danger.
And you know, they had to have wanted to really create that bubble for them to risk all of that, risk everything they knew to come here and start their own little bubble of Puritan brainwashing.
Yeah. But yeah. I don't even know how to describe it. The fact that they were in this new scary environment, that probably also just exacerbated how strict they were. You know, in England, they didn't want to let their kids play because they thought, oh, well, that's frivolous and it leads to the devil. But here, if they went and let their kid play outside, their kid could literally disappear and there's no way that they would really know what happened to them. They could get taken by an animal. They could fall and hurt themselves. They could fall into like a river or, I mean, there's so many horrible things. Yeah, there's so many horrible things that could happen. The dangers were real. So, yeah, let's get into the timeline, I guess. Yeah.
So the timeline is kind of, it can be confusing when it's not clearly in front of you written out. So we're going to try to make it as understandable as possible. So just bear with us. Essentially, the entirety of the Salem Witch Trials really started when Reverend Samuel Parris preached in Salem Village for the first time in November of 1688. So that was really the catalyst for this series of events that took place. It was the thing that set everything off.
It's also important to know about Samuel Parris that he was at least like the third or fourth preacher that had been at this church in a very short period of time. Not only were the people in Salem extremely strict, they bickered all the time. They didn't get along with each other. And because they were so strict, the littlest thing meant that they were like, oh, I'm mad at this preacher. I don't agree with him. We have to kick him out. So a lot of preachers had already been fired. And Samuel Parris is the third or fourth one to come in.
The highest turnover rate in the history of religious preachers.
For real. It's like, what made him take this job? Yeah. My gosh.
But surprisingly, around June of 1689, Samuel Parris was officially hired as the Salem Village minister. So for a span of 6 months, he actually managed to, I guess, impress the Salem Puritans, which...
Yeah, they liked him for six whole months.
Although I don't think we'd like him very much if he was able to do that.
No. I know one of the museums that we actually went to talked about how his wife was mean. And like, she was known to be like kind of hateful, gossipy lady who always had something bad to say about everyone.
So the real witch of Salem.
We get to 1691 and it's October. Joseph Porter, Joseph Hutchinson, Joseph Putnam, so three Josephs.
Just like Beery's last week,
Daniel Andrew and Francis Nurse become the elected majority to the Salem Committee. So these are the people that are leading the town of Salem. It's also important, I just want to note here, that there are two different Salems, right? So there's Salem Town, which is like county seat, so to speak. And then there's Salem Village, which is out in the country. It's like a rural community. But they were kind of the same place. Like, now they're the same place.
And I believe the original Salem Village is actually now Danvers, Massachusetts, not actually quote-unquote Salem.
Yeah.
Something like that.
Danvers is a short little jump over from Salem. When we drove there, we kept seeing, like, signs for Danvers, so.
Like we said, 1688, Samuel Parris preached the first time. 1689, he was officially hired. And then in 1691, these new individuals were elected to the town seat.
Yeah.
And then in 1692, Samuel Parris's 9-year-old daughter, Betty, she fell ill. And after this, more young girls in Salem Village began to fall ill as well. And this is around January. So, you know, it's not an abnormal period where people get sick because you're in a new world. You're in the middle of winter where immune system issues run wild.
We still see that today.
But unfortunately, in February,
The Salem Village physician, Dr. William Griggs, concluded that all of these girls who are sick are not sick with any sort of virus. Well, I guess they probably didn't know what a virus was back then.
The virus is witchcraft.
They're basically bewitched. So whatever has, you know, befallen them, it's not a normal illness. It's something supernatural. The thing to note is that when these girls were sick, they were not sick the way we think about people being sick. They didn't have the flu. They didn't have a head cold or something like that. These girls were like fainting. They were sort of going into these weird comatose states.
Spasming, twitching.
They were spasming, having these weird muscle movements and stuff. They were claiming that people were pinching them and poking them and stabbing them and all kinds of things like that. And this is one of the reasons that today we still don't really know exactly what happened. And of course, we'll talk more about that in theories, but their symptoms were definitely concerning and strange. They went on for a long time.
If anything, it kind of, to me, sounds like epileptic fits. But then, you know, as we start hearing about more of these symptoms, we'll start seeing it doesn't really
make sense.
Up. Yeah.
I think we talk about that a little bit in the theories, too.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, so they've been bewitched, so to speak. That's what everyone thinks. And so by this point, the family is really scared and concerned. They're kind of freaking out. The Paris has had a slave named Tituba and also her husband, John Indian. And the two of them are basically advised by some people that know the Parises to bake a witch cake. Do you know what a witch cake is?
Yes. So a witch cake is... To me, a witch cake is like, it's a little cake
it's
for
a
witch.
It's a pastry.
But
No.
It's composed of a really grainy rye meal. And what they would use as a coagulating agent would be the urine of the afflicted person. So they would mix that all up and then they would shape it into a cake. And sometimes they would heat it over the fire. Other times they would just make it into this little mass, I guess. And then they would feed it to a dog. So the person was considered to be bewitched, quote unquote, if the dog displayed similar symptoms to the afflicted. So essentially they thought that the cake would act as a system of transference.
Yeah.
And it would tell you if you were bewitched or not.
Yes. So Tituba and her husband, John, they do this for the girl, and this will come back to haunt them.
Exactly. On February 29th, Thomas and Edward Putnam, Joseph Hutchinson, and Thomas Preston, they swore complaints against Tituba, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne, and they were later arrested on suspicion of witchcraft. Again, we start to see this very hypocritical, unfair system of justice play out because Mary Sibley, who was the wife of George Sibley, who was a very notable man in the community, she advised them to bake this witch cake, and Tituba essentially took all the blame for that.
Yeah.
And, you know, Sarah Good and Sarah Osborne, two women who didn't necessarily
fit in.
Quote unquote, which in Puritan culture, it was apparently very easy to not fit in.
Yeah. I know in Salem, I can't remember which one of them it was, but I know they talked about how one of them, she was kind of like a beggar woman, you know, she would come and like beg people for money.
Mm-hmm.
And so she would come and knock on your door and ask you for money. And then when you told her to leave, she would get mad and start like harassing you and like just yelling at you and causing this huge commotion.
Honestly, same. I love that.
Yeah. So she was just kind of known to be like a really irritating person in the community. Nobody really liked her.
I feel that. I mean, hey, you gotta do what you gotta do.
Yeah, I know, right? It's also, I think, important probably to note here that things like the witch cake, they were folk remedies for things like bewitchment, but were also sort of like at the same time perceived as magic too, you know? So kind of a thin line between what the Puritans were going to see as witchcraft and what they were going to see as acceptable.
The thing that's important to note is that the Puritans solely drew that line.
Yeah.
So they had...
They could draw it wherever they wanted.
Exactly. And that's part of the reason that this...
From one day to another.
...became so crazy. It's also important to note that, according to sources, these three individuals were specifically accused because the girls who were afflicted shouted out their names. And that's why these men went to the town council and swore these complaints against them.
Yeah. So the Salem Town magistrates, John Hathorne and Jonathan Corwin, examined Tituba, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne. Now, before I go on, I want to say an interesting fact, which is that John Hathorne had a very, very famous descendant Nathaniel Hawthorne, whose name is Hawthorne instead of Hathorne, because he was so ashamed that this guy was his relative that he added the W between the A and the T.
Which, like, poor Nathaniel.
I know.
He was like, I'm going to change my entire last name. He's just like,
oh gosh, get me away from these people. They're crazy. So basically, they examine Tituba, Sarah Good, and Sarah Osborne. Tituba confesses to witchcraft. You know, a lot of people will ask the question, well, why would she confess? She wasn't a witch. Why would she do that? Why would she confess to a crime that she didn't commit? So it's really important to know that Tituba was a slave. She was not just a servant in the Paris household. She was a slave. Different sources say different things. A lot of times the story is told that she was a Black African slave, but when we were in Salem, we actually heard, I guess from the sources that seemed the most reliable, that she probably was actually Native American, probably from somewhere like Guatemala, somewhere in like Central America, and then was brought as a slave to slave markets in the Caribbean and then sold to the English colonies. And that's how she ended up in Massachusetts. And so not only has she had a really traumatic life already up to this point, but she understands, like, she's not stupid, she's smart, and she knows that it's probably better for her to just say, hey, yep, you know what? I did it. I'm sorry. I did it and I'm sorry. That'll probably get her farther than just trying to defend herself. And I think it's hard for all of us to understand what that's like because we've never been in a situation like that and we haven't really been in a society like the Puritans. But I think for her, she was just trying to do what she could to survive.
And I think that's something that needs to be better understood when we discuss this as well, because I think it's so easy from our spot in history to look back and be like, why would you admit to something like that? But also the fact that some of these examinations were incredibly intense and honestly, there was almost no way you could get out of it without admitting to something that you didn't do.
It was definitely a thing of, if you confessed, they usually would just put you in jail and take your land away from you and your property. If you refused to confess, there was no innocent until proven guilty. You were just always perceived as guilty. And so if you did not confess to the crime of witchcraft, well then not confessing and lying about it and keeping the secret, so to speak, was a worse crime than the witchcraft even. Always the people who were executed actually were the people that defended themselves and refused to confess to crimes they didn't commit.
Like, you will not suffer a witch to live. So that was on March 1st where Tituba confessed to having done witchcraft.
All three of them, Tituba, Sarah Osborne, and Sarah Good, they're all sent to prison in Boston.
And then after that, Martha Corey was summoned to appear before the magistrates and to answer questions on March 14th.
And at this point, you know, everybody in town is attending these trials. They're all sitting there watching and witnessing people testifying and being questioned and whatnot. And whenever one of the accused would say, oh, no, I'm totally innocent, Betty Paris and all of her friends would start writhing on the floor and yelling and screaming to make it look like or seem like they were being attacked in that moment by the person that's trying to defend themselves.
And it's really important that Martha Corey, she was known for her piety and for her dedicated church attendance in the Salem community. She had never shown support for the witch trials, as she didn't believe witches or warlocks existed, which is different in that community, because despite being such a pious churchgoer, she didn't necessarily ascribe to these more paranoid sentiments of the Puritans. Yeah. She publicly denounced the witch trials time and time again, and she had been very outspoken in the belief that the girls who were accusing all of these individuals, that they were lying. And upon apparently hearing about this, it was then that Ann Putnam Jr., I believe, and Mercy Lewis, they both accused her of witchcraft.
There's this whole, like, group of a bunch of girls, like these sort of preteen and teenage girls that are making all of these accusations. They're naming all of these women. They're really turning it all into this spectacle, right? I mean, it was a show. It was literally a show. You know, you could go and watch, and they'd put these women up on the stand and say, are you a witch? And the women would say, of course not. And then the girls, if they felt like it that day, they would start screaming and freaking out and crying and accusing her of, in that moment, like casting spells on them.
Martha Corey professed her innocence in front of the judge. She was like, you should believe me, a pious churchgoer, not these hysterical ramblings of these girls.
Dumb kids.
Exactly. Although, I hate using the word hysterical because of its origins.
Yeah. But, bad juju. But
the girls really latched on to that, I guess, and just went with it. After she was summoned March 14th, on March 19th, a warrant was issued for her arrest. On the same day, Abigail Williams, who was one of the afflicted girls, she accused Rebecca Nurse of witchcraft.
It's just growing in numbers very quickly.
It's tumbling downhill. Yeah. It's adding snow to the snowball.
Yeah. Basically, Edward and Jonathan Putnam file complaints against Rebecca Nurse. She then appears before the Salem magistrates, and the girls do their thing.
Rebecca Nurse was 71 years old, and
she's an old lady.
She was people often called her an invalid. You like, know this girl is not out shaking her old bones in the in the woods, you know, outside Salem Village.
Dancing around a fire, you know.
Dancing around with the devil. Sky clad with the devil. Like, you know it.
Come on.
She literally said,
like, she literally could hardly get out of her house.
Exactly. She was like, I am innocent as the child unborn, but surely what sin hath God found that he should lay such an affliction on me in my old age? So she literally was like, what the hell, God?
Yeah.
She was like, why are you letting these girls do this? She was also considered to be very pious. She was really friendly with her neighbors, and she was a very benevolent person.
Yeah. People didn't have complaints about her prior to this. Like, yeah. She was just totally...
And even one woman who had been angry at her before for, I guess, something about her pigs coming into her yard or something, she later, like, changed her tone, and she spoke in Rebecca's defense. So,
oh, that's so sweet, though.
You know, there's all these people who were being accused who really were some of the best, in my opinion, people in this community.
Mm-hmm. So we get some more accusations. A really big one that happens is one of the afflicted girls, Mercy Lewis, she accuses Elizabeth Proctor of witchcraft. And this is a person that a lot of you guys have probably heard of if you have ever read The Crucible, because her husband, John Proctor, he also is accused later on. John Proctor, in particular, I did not know this until I went to Salem, but I thought this was very interesting. He actually was another person who was kind of like, these trials are not doing anyone service. They need to stop. This is out of hand. This is ridiculous. There are no witches in Salem. This is absurd. Basically, word sort of started to get around that that was his view, and the girls accuse his wife, and then they accuse him. And at this point, people just trust these girls and their accusations so much. They're like, why would these girls act this way? The idea that the girls would make it up or would pretend or would have some other illness that's causing them to react this way or feel this way is just, they can't comprehend that. It doesn't make sense to them at the time.
The girls really, I think they most often had fits or were quote unquote tormented by Elizabeth's specter.
Yeah.
And they really made this whole deal about it.
Yeah, so they would say that, like, the person wasn't physically coming to them. They would say that their, like, ghostly image or their specter was...
Or their familiar.
Yes, or their animal familiar was coming and sort of terrorizing them. And the only people that supposedly could see your specter was the person that's being terrorized, right? Mm-hmm. So, you know, if somebody's specter is terrorizing me, you're not going to be able to see it, but I can.
Yeah.
I can see it.
And we're going to believe that because that's completely credible.
Yes, yes. But this is kind of known as spectral evidence. It becomes sort of a controversial part of the witch trials, even at the time.
Because I think this was one of the first times where spectral evidence and not concrete evidence was allowed into a court system and a court trial.
Yeah.
And I think that's also where they started to go wrong. Because
oh, for sure. Because there's no way to prove that spectral evidence is real or not real. You're just trusting what somebody says, and it's kind of their word against everyone else. So they arrest a whole bunch more people. Mary Eastie, Edward and Sarah Bishop, Deliverance and William Hobbs, Sarah Wilds, Mary Black, Nehemiah Abbott Jr., and Mary English.
When these people were accused, they had to submit to these physical examinations.
They were very invasive.
Male doctor, and sometimes women would accompany him if it was another woman. Sometimes it would just be the male doctor, so it depended. And they were completing a physical examination that was very thorough and very invasive. They looked for literally any type of birth defect, any mole, mm-hmm. any marking, any scar. And the thing is that when you're living in a Puritan community mm-hmm. and you're doing chores day in and day out, you're not allowed to play. You inevitably
have these things.
Exactly. You would have scars, you know, from chopping wood, marks from scrubbing floors. Literally almost any type of marking or sign mm-hmm. was believed to be a witch's mark. But something that's important is that examiners found no marks on Elizabeth Proctor.
Yeah.
So that's something that in the trial they just brush right over.
Yeah. Because well, this kind of became a normal thing where the evidence stopped going along with their view of what made somebody a witch.
Exactly.
And actually, on April 21st, Abigail Williams identifies the Reverend George Burroughs as the black minister. George Burroughs, I'm pretty sure he was kind of a pastor that had been rejected from some of the Salem churches. He wasn't quite as strict as a lot of these Puritans wanted him to be, and so he was fired. And so naturally that made him an easy target. However, he still is a preacher. He still knows the Bible really, really well. He still is a very, very devout believer. He is obviously somebody who is not fraternizing with the devil, mm-hmm. not hanging out with the devil, but he gets accused anyway, and they believe these girls when the accusation is made.
It's terrifying to think to what extent this would have persisted mm-hmm. and how many people could have been accused or would have been accused and then executed or punished or imprisoned. Just the amount of power that these girls had. It's just terrifying to think that they could literally mm-hmm. point the finger at anyone, and evidence or not, they would be in a lot of trouble. Yeah.
So I'm just going to kind of jump through the timeline, because basically from this point on, we have just a whole bunch more accusations, tons more, really, really a lot. By this point, we have a lot of people in jail. It's now June.
Mm-hmm. Oh, no, Sarah Osborne died in prison
while she
was waiting.
Yeah, because Sarah was an older lady. Mm-hmm. We skip forward to June 10th, and one of the accused, Bridget Bishop, is the first person to be executed in the Salem Witch Trials. A popular myth is that witches were always burned at the stake. This was true in certain parts of Europe, like Spain and France, but it was not really true with the English, meaning that the Puritans were not going to burn people at the stake. Mm-hmm. So instead, they hang Bridget Bishop at Gallows Hill. The site of the old Gallows Hill, it's not entirely known exactly where it was. It's important to know that with Salem, there was a fire in the late 1800s, that burned a lot of the city down, and so it destroyed a lot of history. Mm-hmm. So a lot of things have been lost, but they have kind of an idea of where it might have been, which is cool. But she's the first person to be hanged. 5 days later, 12 ministers in the colony actually advise these courts not to rely on spectral evidence for convicting suspected witches.
Which, you're about 3 years too late at this point.
Like, dude, somebody died like 5 days ago because of spectral evidence. On June 29th, the cases of Sarah Good, Sarah Wilds, Elizabeth Howe, Susanna Martin, and Rebecca Nurse are finally heard by the court. About a month later, Sarah Good, Elizabeth Howe, Sarah Wilds, Susanna Martin, and Rebecca Nurse are hanged. So now we have, how many people is that? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 people that have been killed in a month, mm-hmm. basically.
And so that terrified people, but
yeah.
John Proctor and his wife that was accused, and their daughter Sarah was accused, as was their son William.
Yeah, their whole family.
They,
which was kind of how this went. It was a lot of, like, whole families.
Exactly. If one person in the family was accused, it kind of started to extend to others. Mm-hmm. Because John Proctor feared that they couldn't get a fair trial in Salem Town, and the other prisoners also felt the same way, these individuals wrote a letter from their prison to Reverend Increase Mather, to Reverend James Allen, Reverend Joshua Moody, Reverend Samuel Willard, and Reverend John Bailey. And in this letter, they asked the ministers to support their request for a change of venue for the trials so that they would hopefully have a semblance of a fair trial.
Yeah. I don't know if Increase Mather is the person you want to go to for that.
This is the infamous witch hunter, everyone.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, Increase published a lot of different pamphlets about the devil, about Satan, evil spirits, witchcraft. Mm-hmm. And so he set a precedent for consultation of these pamphlets and that kind of less evidence-based thinking when it came to these trials.
A lot of the sort of knowledge that sort of random people in Salem would have had of what makes somebody a witch, what signs and symptoms to look out for, would have come from the pamphlets mm-hmm. that the Mathers wrote.
And also the Malleus Maleficarum.
Yeah.
Which yeah. was a really big religious pamphlet that would essentially describe witches, mm-hmm. demon worshippers.
It was kind of the guide. Which is just wild that that existed. Like, what?
I think it's, I don't know, it's just so funny to me. It's like, you have the Farmer's Almanac, and then you also have the Malleus Maleficarum. Yeah, they're like
on the same shelf at the general store.
What do you need today? Oh, give me one of the Malleus Maleficarums. I don't know if you've actually tried to read it.
I have
it's
not.
It's utterly ridiculous.
I'm sure it is. Like, I know some of the stuff that's in there. I'm just like, mm-hmm. no.
Are you okay?
I listened to a podcast about Matthew Hopkins, the mm-hmm. Witchfinder General in yeah. England, and how he was just a grifter, mm-hmm. basically. Like, yeah. he didn't even really believe the stuff he was
exactly.
saying.
He was like, I'll just like, execute people and point the finger for money.
Just give me money. Yeah.
Which is so, I don't know.
Unsurprising, but like also
it's
frustrating.
Very American.
Yeah, he wasn't American, but it's very American. We love our grifters over here.
So after these reverends are contacted, it ends up that more individuals are tried and even more individuals are yeah. hung. And unfortunately, this would include John Proctor, who had sent the letter. His wife Elizabeth actually wasn't hung. Her execution was stayed because she was pregnant. Mm-hmm. It turns out that on August 19th, George Burroughs, John Proctor, George Jacobs Sr., John Willard, and Martha Carrier were all hung on Gallows Hill.
This is actually also a turning point in terms of the way the public supported the witch trials, mm-hmm. because George Burroughs, as we discussed, he was a reverend. And one of the beliefs about witches at the time was that if you were a witch, you could not recite the Lord's Prayer. So George Burroughs, in a last-ditch attempt to prove that he's not a witch, when he gets up on the gallows, he starts reciting the Lord's Prayer, and he is able to finish it, which, if he were a witch, he wouldn't be able to do. And, you know, everybody watching, because, you know, these are public executions, everybody watching is immediately just like, no, oh my gosh, you can't kill him, right? He's clearly not a witch, he's just proved his innocence. And basically, some of the judges and reverends that are supporting his execution, they kind of get up there and they talk the people down and say, oh no, look at all the evidence we've already seen. This man is clearly a witch. Don't be swayed. Don't be swayed by him citing the Lord's Prayer. That's just a trick of the devil.
Why would not all of these individuals have recited the Lord's Prayer?
Yeah.
And then if that would sway all of those people, then why didn't, you know, all these other signs of mm-hmm. them not being witches not convince them? It's this is where it really pisses me off, because
yeah.
it's such a pick and choose system. And that's right. when it comes to law and you have pick and choose systems mm-hmm. and you don't have a completely evidence-based system of
right. and like a concrete guideline of like what evidence is.
Exactly.
What evidence is needed to,
just,
you know.
It bothers yeah, me so much.
So irritating. So then now it's September. So this has been 9 months of witch hysteria in Salem. Mm-hmm. It's been, you know, the entire year of 1692 so far. And we have 6 more people that are accused, and they're tried and then condemned by the court. One of those accused is Giles Corey, another person you've probably heard about before. And there mm-hmm. are a lot of things about him that seem like they might be a myth, but they actually are not myths, which is actually kind of cool, because Giles Corey was, in terms of his death, really, like, he had a cool death, I guess.
He's a badass.
Yeah.
I mean, to put it plainly.
Just to put it plainly, there's not really a better way to describe him. He was not known to be a very nice person, but when he got accused, he also showed that he was pretty smart. Because if you were executed in these trials, all of your possessions were essentially confiscated by the government. So you lost everything you had. That meant your family would be left destitute, mm-hmm. without anything. If you admitted that you were a witch and were just thrown in jail instead of executed, the thing is that in these days, being in prison was not free. So basically, you literally had to pay to stay in jail.
Which is so funny.
I know, right? It's so strange. If you couldn't pay, they would start, you know, confiscating your land and stuff like that. So mm-hmm. he could potentially lose his land that way if he didn't pay. or it would bankrupt him in order to pay to have a survivable jail sentence. Because if you didn't have a lot of money, they were going to give you hardly any conveniences while you're in prison. You're going to have a pretty miserable time. If you had money to pay, you might be able to pay for, you know, a private cell or a nicer cell, more comfortable area to sleep or better food, more water, things like that. So this is definitely a process that could easily bankrupt somebody. So basically, he did not want to risk all this financial stuff. So he refused to plead innocent or guilty. And this led to the court being like, you know what, if you're not going to plead one way or the other, we're just going to torture you until you change your mind. So what they did was they basically strapped him down onto the floor, or onto the ground rather, placed a wooden board over top of his body and started piling up these heavy stones on top of him. This would effectively crush him. And as the weight gets heavier and heavier and heavier, it's going to be harder to breathe, harder to move, harder to focus, harder to do anything. The hope, of course, is that eventually this will kind of force him to plead one way or the other just to get the weight off. Whenever the court asks him, do you have anything to say? Do you want to plead? He just keeps saying, more weight.
What a badass.
I know. It's just such a good story.
It's so sad it happened, but
yeah,
what a way to go.
I know. It was, you know, kind of one of those things where I sort of expected that to be like a myth, you know, something that he didn't really say, but he did. It's really believed that he did say that, which is really cool.
They didn't elicit a confession either way, but he did die of...
He died. He was basically pressed to death is what...
Which is a horrible way to die.
He's basically crushed.
Yeah.
Suffocated by rocks. Because, you know,
his ribs would be cracked.
Yeah.
His lungs would be compressed.
Probably punctured by his ribs.
Yeah. Horrible way to die, but he went out like a badass, and he is remembered as such, so...
Yep.
The day after the sheriff orders Giles Corey to be basically pressed to death, 9 more are accused and tried... and then condemned by the court. September 19th, Giles Corey, of course, is pressed to death. And then September 22nd,
Martha Corey, Mary Easty, Alice Parker, Ann Pudiator, Margaret Scott, Wilmot Reed, Samuel Wardwell, and Mary Parker are all hanged on Gallows Hill. And Mary Herrick of Wyndham, Massachusetts, which is a nearby town, reports that the ghost of Mary Easty appeared to her and proclaimed her innocence of witchcraft. So this just really goes to show how these witch trials are now making it out of Salem. No longer is this something that's kind of confined to the city of Salem. It's something that is in the wider community of the Massachusetts colony.
And I believe even the Salem witch trials were reported back to England.
I'm sure.
And the people in England were like, what the hell are they doing
over there? What is going
they
on? Were
like, they leave for religious freedom and suddenly they're all persecuting themselves. Like. Or they don't leave for religious freedom, but they leave to, you know, have their own bubble.
And now they're murdering each other.
They're all killing each other.
Yeah.
They're like, good riddance. October 19th, Increase Mather visited the Salem jail and had encounters with several confessors that wished to renounce their earlier testimonies, which makes sense because...
Same.
I mean, all of them were pretty much forced.
So on October 29th, things finally start coming to an end. Governor Phipps, who is the governor of the colony, he dissolves the court of Oyer and Terminer, which is the court that is handling all of these proceedings. So on November 25th, so about a month after the court is dissolved, a superior court of judicature is created to try the remaining persons that are accused of witchcraft. William Staunton, Samuel Sewell, John Richards, Waite Still Winthrop. These names, guys.
I know.
These names are so weird. And Thomas Danford are its members, and spectral evidence is no longer considered as being reliable evidence.
Freaking long enough.
I know, it literally took them like a year.
Exactly.
To figure this out, that spectral evidence is a way to lie.
It really makes you wonder if a superior court of judicature had been appointed earlier, if any of these people would have even died.
Yeah, because, I mean, so many of them were convicted based on spectral evidence, and the girls in the courtroom, they would say, oh, her specter, she's attacking me right now. She, her body is up on the stand, you know, but her specter is attacking me, but you guys can't see it because it's her specter, and I'm the only one that can see it.
Which is like, okay. Okay, Mary.
All right.
All right,
sure,
Mary.
Abigail. Seems legit.
And then in 1693 in May, Governor Phipps finally pardoned the remaining who were accused of witchcraft. So they were essentially the only ones to escape the
hanging. I think the total of deaths is 20, right? I think it's 19 people are hanged, and then Giles Corey, who is pressed to death, is the 20th person. But there's... That's something that a lot of people don't realize, is that while these 20 people died, a lot of times they're the only ones that people talk about, the only ones that get remembered. But there were hundreds of other people that were in jail, some of whom were in jail for, you know, the up until the end of their lives because they died in jail. There are people who were in jail for the rest of their lives simply because they couldn't pay the debt that they ended up owing to jail for having to stay there. There are people who lost everything that they had, you know, and were basically just kind of thrown out on the streets into poverty, destroyed like a whole community, basically.
Mm-hmm. So in total, you know, 19 people were hanged.
Mm-hmm.
Five had died in custody.
Okay.
Giles Corey was pressed, and then I believe two dogs were shot because they killed them after the witch cakes had been eaten.
That's so mean.
This is in the span of a year.
It's just crazy.
They lost 25 members of their community and two pups.
And, you know, these were not huge communities like today. You know, today Salem is a city. You know, Boston is its neighbor. Big, big city. 25 people dying in a year wouldn't be quite as dramatic, but this was a small community. I mean, everybody knew each other.
Also makes this entirely more horrible.
Yeah, I mean, it's literally friends accusing each other of these horrific crimes, and it's hard to imagine that happening in our community.
It's so interesting to me, mm-hmm. the effect that religion or any type of very, very strong belief akin to religion can mm-hmm. have. The effect of religious fervor and religious mm-hmm. frenzy, or, you know, political fervor and political frenzy. It's just, it's so insane, and people will turn on each other.
Yeah.
And it's very disheartening as well.
Yeah.
So.
It kind of reminds me just the fact that this happened in such a short period of time. All these people died. Yesterday, for the class that I'm taking right now, I had to watch this documentary called Ghost of Rwanda, which mm-hmm. is about the Rwandan genocide, which obviously is dramatically worse than the Salem witch trials in every way. But that genocide lasted for 100 days. That's how long the Rwandan civil war went on. Mm-hmm. And in that 100-day period, just a couple of months, 500,000 people were murdered. And those people were not soldiers fighting in the war. Those were normal people like mm-hmm. you and me.
And also, it's not very well known either.
Yeah.
It gets glossed over in history so often.
I mean, I knew very little other than the very, very basic gist of it. I didn't know, you know, like, how it started. I didn't know how many people died. I just knew it was a really bad thing that had happened.
Yep. One of the most ironic things, really, is that Salem comes from the Hebrew word shalom, which means peace.
Yeah.
And so, the irony, the pure irony.
Yeah, it's like, this is the least peaceful place ever.
Neighbors turn on neighbors. Families are accused. Dogs are shot.
They never did anything to anyone.
So now that we've kind of gotten the main story out of the way, let's move on to theories. The first one is just the girls made it up. They were behind it.
I don't know. This is kind of my pet theory, I think. Mm-hmm. Whenever we were in Salem, we went on a history tour, like a history walking tour, and mm-hmm. it was really, really good. And our tour guide, he pretty much was of the same mind, too, as were quite a few of the other people that we spoke to who were the experts working at museums and stuff. They all seem to be kind of this idea. I don't know if there's a reason that this is the sort of mainstream idea in Salem. I don't really know, but it's definitely the one that, to me, I think makes the most sense. And that is this idea that the girls just made it all up. When all this started, you do have these girls having these fits. And the thing is that there was another smaller witch trial that had happened like a couple hours away in a nearby town just a few years prior to the Salem witch trials. It's something mm-hmm. that's like not very widely known. The thing is though that this was like widely reported in the newspapers in the Boston, Salem area. And there were a lot of similarities between what the children in that story said happened to them and what these girls ended up saying was happening to them. Mm-hmm. So it's highly possible that the girls had read and heard about those stories. Something that a lot of people don't realize is that Salem was actually a very, very literate place. The Puritans, because they were so religious, they required everyone, men and women, to learn to read. Women were not always taught to write, but they were always taught to read so that they could read the Bible. So they were not just people who could, you know, read enough to like read a sentence. I mean, they could read very well. They could mm-hmm. read the Bible. And so that definitely means that these girls could read other books. They could read pamphlets that they had from the Mathers. They could read King James I's Demonology, which was, you know, a work about how demons are everywhere. they definitely not only would have grown up in a, you know, Puritan society that was teaching them to always be looking out for these things, but they would have had direct sources telling them exactly how to act in order to convince people that there are witches attacking you. Mm-hmm. And so why would they do that? Why would they want people to think that? And there's a variety of reasons that people think, you know, one is that some of their parents had issues with their neighbors, and it could have been, you know, a situation where it was like, oh, well, you know, I heard mom and dad talking about our neighbor, Sarah, and how they don't like her, so mm-hmm. I'm going to accuse her of witchcraft, and then she'll be dead, and we won't have to worry about her anymore. And, you know, they're kids, so they're not really thinking about the fact that they're going to have to live with themselves, you know? It also could have just been that they wanted attention. You know, like I said earlier, these were kids who had no real childhood. They were not allowed to play. They weren't really allowed a lot of toys. They weren't allowed anything frivolous. They never got to do anything fun. Everything was strict, religion, chores, work. And obviously, especially the women, they were just extremely repressed. And everybody was always just critical of you and looking at you, judging you and trying to make sure that you weren't doing anything you weren't supposed to be doing. So naturally, it's possible that the girls just really wanted some form of attention that they were craving that they couldn't otherwise get. And pretending to be sick, that's a pretty good way to get your parents' attention, full stop. Like, you're gonna get all of their attention if you're really sick.
It almost, to me, is Munchausen's.
Yeah.
Definitely reminds me of a manifestation of Munchausen's, which would make sense also if it manifested in some form of PTSD just because of the fact that they were so suppressed.
Yeah. Well, and that's the thing I feel like people don't realize is like, or don't think about, is the fact that even if these girls had never seen anything traumatic, their daily lives were traumatic because they were basically being abused all the time.
Exactly. You know, nothing to look forward to in life.
A lot of people have PTSD from that kind of abuse, so it's understandable that they would have it too.
And I know there's probably going to be, if moms listen to this and are like, it's not abusive to have your kids do chores and stuff like that. And that's not what we mean.
That's not what we're talking
about. We're talking about taking it to the extreme. When your child has literally nothing to look forward to day to day.
They live like tiny adults.
They wake up. They start their chores immediately. They have a very simple breakfast. You know, they continue doing their chores. They attend service. They continue doing chores. They attend a Bible reading. They attend a prayer service. They eat a very simple dinner. They go to bed early. They do it all again.
Yeah. And it's like that every single day of their
lives. There's nothing to look forward to.
Yeah.
The thought of it is terrifying to me.
It's just not a very good environment to be in. So I definitely think there's that element that they could have just been just looking for attention and the things that children really do need. Part of the support for this theory is that one of the girls who made all of these accusations was Ann Putnam. And much later, when she was an adult, she publicly apologized for her part in the witch trials. She literally went in front of the church and gave this, like, speech about, or actually, I don't think she spoke. I think she had written it out and the reverend, like, read it. But it was her apology. And she definitely took full responsibility for all of it and, like, encouraged all of the other girls to do the same. But I don't think they did. I think that on one hand, it's possible that she was saying, like, hey, I was a kid and I did this really stupid thing and now I realize that I destroyed a bunch of lives and killed a bunch of people, you know. It's also possible that, you know, she's literally just saying, like, we thought this really was happening to us. Like, we truly believed it and thought that this is what was going on and now I realize we were wrong. So
I mean, she says she didn't do it out of anger, out of malice, spite, ill will, but she did say that she did it ignorantly, being deluded by Satan.
Yeah.
So I wonder if it was less of a being deluded by Satan and being kind of led by the other girls.
Yeah. And peer pressure.
Yeah.
And again, I think their parents honestly might have had a lot of influence on them too, because, you know, if you notice, it's not like they were accusing each other's parents. They were accusing people their parents didn't like a lot of the time. And that's really how the accusations went from being towards people in the community that were not well-liked to being accusations towards people that were in high standing. Another theory that a lot of you guys have probably actually heard before, because it's one that's like put in a lot of documentaries and stuff like that, is ergot poisoning. So there's this fungus called ergot, which grows on rye, and it can be really widespread on rye crops. And basically, if your crop gets infested with ergot, your whole crop is poisoned. In these days, it might have been difficult for them to realize that their crop was infested. Definitely would have been hard for them to prevent the infestation of ergot. And if it got into the town's supply of grain, it could have led to some pretty bizarre symptoms once they started eating mm-hmm. the grain, you know? The symptoms are pretty bad. I mean, they can cause, like, hallucinations and fevers mm-hmm. and all kinds of just strange.
A form of it was literally the basis for LSD.
Yeah. So yeah. It's very intense. It's like a drug, also, guys. It's very intense.
It has these little things that it produces called ergotamines, essentially. And these constrict blood vessels and cause, weirdly, the muscles of the uterus to contract.
Oh.
So it's definitely why people think it would affect females more than males.
Men. Yeah.
But I definitely don't think that
I don't either.
It would solely affect these girls. It would affect the adults as well.
Yeah, it would affect the adults too. The men would have been having hallucinations just as often as the women. Mm-hmm. The women might have just had some different symptoms. Yeah, it just doesn't make sense. And actually, we kind of see this with a lot of the stuff, is a lot of like medical explanations. It's like, well, why would it only be them, you mm-hmm. know? Another really interesting thing about ergot, though, is that it shows up in unsolved historical mysteries a lot because, you know, rye is pretty common. It's a common grain mm-hmm. and it commonly gets poisoned, or at least it used to in those days. I know one of the really common things that it's kind of used as an explanation for is when people look at the biblical 10 plagues of Egypt mm-hmm. and they try to explain how the final plague, which was the death of the firstborn son, what kind of illness would have only affected the oldest son. And they think that it could have been ergot poisoning, that basically all of these other plagues sort of combined to have a food shortage and famine. And so the grain that was left was infected with this fungus. And because in those days in Egypt, the male heir, the oldest son, you know, he was the most important person in the family, essentially, because he's carrying on the family legacy, the family name, he's going to inherit everything. He would have been fed before anybody else. And so it's likely that he is the guy who's getting, you know, normal amount of food while everyone else is hungry. And so naturally, he's the one that's going to die from this crazy fungus poisoning him.
It's also credited, not sure, but accredited to being one of the main reasons for some of the dancing plagues.
Oh, yeah, because there were lots of those, mm-hmm. but it makes sense because they would have just been hallucinating.
Yep.
And it could also explain why, like, they were dancing when there's no music. They were hallucinating mm-hmm. that there was music.
It's just so weird, though, because if I was hallucinating, I don't know if I would necessarily be dancing. Yeah. I'd probably be, like, lying on the floor, rocking myself uh-huh. back and forth.
Yeah.
But I guess it also depends, like, are you hallucinating bugs all around you
exactly.
or bats all around you?
Well, and also, are you otherwise sick when you're hallucinating, mm-hmm. right?
So, very like, true.
I know my great aunt right now, she's unfortunately very, very, very sick and probably won't be with us for very much longer. And every now and then she doesn't have all of her mental faculties and she has some strange dreams and hallucinations and things like that. Sometimes she has these ones that people are playing music, like neighbors outside are playing loud music, which is not happening. Mm. And so we're always like, what? Because she'll start being like, why is that music playing? And it just played all night. And we're like, what? And then we realize, oh, it was like a dream or like some weird like vision she had or whatever.
She's getting down to
yeah.
So,
I mean,
music.
Definitely people hallucinate music. I mean, you know, it's a thing.
Mm-hmm. Kind of another medical-esque reason yeah. for the girls doing this is encephalitis lethargica, mm-hmm. which is essentially where the girls were suffering from a type of encephalitis, which is a swelling of the brain. It was apparently spread to them by animals. And the symptoms of this are high fever, sore throat, headache, lethargy, double vision, delayed physical and mental responses, sleep inversion, catatonia, abnormal eye movements, Parkinsonism, upper body weakness, muscular pains, tremors, neck rigidity, and behavioral changes like psychosis. This was first proposed in 1991 by Lori Wynn Carlson, but it still doesn't explain mm-hmm. why only the girls would have had this and not anyone else.
Yeah, this and the ergot poisoning and any other sort of like real medical explanation, they just don't explain how the girls would just, you know, suddenly be like besieged by these symptoms in the middle of the courtroom. Like mm-hmm. that just doesn't make any sense.
At very opportune
yeah
moments.
You know, like it just seems like, wow, the symptom, like you're totally fine all week and then you go into court and suddenly you're sick again.
Mm-hmm.
Mysterious.
If it was spread to them by animals,
yeah,
I would think that other people would be affected, because
yeah.
even if the girls were in charge of feeding the animals,
right,
the fathers or the sons or whatever, they would yeah. still be in charge of butchering the animals, of helping the animals when they were having babies, that kind of thing. So
yeah. lots of adults would have it, like little boys would have it too, not just mm-hmm. little girls. It would be a common thing in their community. And I feel like because it would have been fairly common, it wouldn't have been so shocking when they fell sick. The doctor would have been like, oh, yeah, I've seen this before. You know?
Well, that doctor was like he straight up wasn't like, a very good this doctor, is but... bewitchment. Are you sure about that, sir?
But I mean, I just got the impression that it was the kind of thing where he was like, oh, I've never seen anything like this before, you know?
Yeah.
So I feel like if it was something that spread from animals to humans, that it would probably be more commonly seen.
Yeah. And then again, for anything they never saw before was always accredited to being demonic.
Oh, yeah.
So, and then another medical related thing is Lyme disease, but...
In our notes, I literally said, Lyme disease. No. I was like, mean, that doesn't make any sense.
Like people say, if these girls went out to the woods and frogged in the woods and they were bitten by ticks.
But I'm sure all of these people had ticks. But
exactly. And I can't see it affecting them the same exact way.
Like, and in the same period of time, so quickly.
Exactly.
And again, symptoms don't just randomly show up and disappear like that when you want them to.
So conveniently.
Yeah.
PTSD is the next one.
Yeah. We kind of already talked about that. And I think that PTSD definitely could have been either kind of its own thing, just because symptoms of PTSD are really varied and widespread. And for people that don't know what they're looking at can be scary, you know, because you're like, why is this person freaking out? Why are they acting this way? What's going on? And it definitely wouldn't have been diagnosed in anybody in those days. I mean, it wasn't really diagnosed until after World War II. And even then it was not really understood until after Vietnam. So it's possible that the girls had it. I don't know if it's really that good of an explanation as to why. Like, I don't think it really explains their symptoms too much, though. But I do think that it could have contributed to them choosing to act the way that they were, you know, to put on a like a facade of being
sick. I think
so
too.
Yeah.
And also having PTSD means that if they did have PTSD, you can't hold them to the same
standards,
responsibilities, the same consternation as you would if they were just doing this out of their own volition and free will, because it's much different. And something that I think ties into PTSD is literally the article I did for the magazine, which I fully think that the Salem witch trials affecting these girls was a somatoform disorder in a combination either with PTSD or hysteria, which again, I hate using that word, but unfortunately it is a term today. Essentially, it's this idea that they had this PTSD affecting them. They had this life growing up where the devil was always around them. They always were exposed to him. There was always sin to be looking out for. So I proposed that the Salem witch trials were a case of what's called mass conversion disorder. And this is due to high stress, PTSD, and a really demanding social sphere. And then I also said that the eating disorder, PICA, was kind of in conjunction with this.
I've heard this before, yeah.
Yeah,
maybe
so,
from you, I don't know.
Maybe, I don't know. I do like to talk about it a lot, but mass conversion disorder, essentially, it's also known as mass psychogenic illness or mass hysteria, and it's labeled as a dissociative disorder and a somatoform disorder by two separate diagnostic scales, the ICD-10 and the DSM-4. This dissociative disorder is defined as a, quote, disorder that involves disruptions or breakdowns of memory, awareness, identity, or perception, while a somatoform disorder is a mental disorder that results in largely inexplicable physical manifestations. So essentially, MCD is a disorder that affects a cohesive group of persons, people who are within the same social sphere, and is especially common in tightly knit communities. And there's really no greater an example of a tight-knit community than the Puritans, being almost cult-like in this religious devotion and the quickness to band together and condemn sin and profess someone as doing the devil's work is just two major aspects of this that really stood out to me. MCD is really commonly attributed with female communities that are under vast social pressure and constrictions. For example, something that is kind of a modern day manifestation of this, in 2012, a group of cheerleaders from Leroy, New York, were diagnosed with MCD, and their symptoms may sound eerily familiar. So, muscle spasms leading to uncontrollable twitching and jerking, extreme vomiting, intense delusions and hallucinations, accusations, paranoia. They were also commonly saying that they felt the sensation of being pricked by pins, as well as a loss of sensation altogether. A lot of explanations of this were given for those girls specifically, saying it was the HPV vaccine, it was a chemical spill on the grounds of the school, and some people said demonic interference.
Of course they did.
319 years after the witch trials ended,
people still don't get that there are no witches casting spells.
The same symptoms manifest, and these same people are like, it's demonic possession.
It's never demonic possession.
So, I mean, it's little surprise that 1692 Puritans would think it was demonic possession then. The 2012 case is not the only recent case to be reported. Surprisingly, a similar case occurred in 2002 in a North Carolina high school.
Really?
So, yeah. Wow. Once again, among cheerleaders.
Weird.
And it happened again in 2007 at an all-girls Catholic boarding school in Mexico City. And
I think I've heard of that one before.
Yeah. So all three of these affected young females under extreme social pressure and tight-knit spheres. And they had a lot of the same intense symptoms. Specifically, when I talk about the somatoform and hysteria disorders being associated with pica, there are some documents that say that some of the girls in the Salem witch trials reported throwing up needles, pins, and other sorts of objects that really aren't normal. Pica is a compulsive eating disorder where people eat substances with no nutritional value, and this manifests mostly in children and youth. Surprisingly, from between 4% to 26% of children and youth.
Wow.
And pica is usually not found by itself. It's usually accompanied by a mental disorder, such as schizophrenia, obsessive compulsive disorders, depression, intense anxiety disorders, MCD. It's not specifically labeled or categorized as one of those disorders, but it does, however, have the dissociative aspect of schizophrenia through these delusions and hallucinations. Mm-hmm. And the obsessive compulsive aspect of scratching, hair pulling, biting due to psychosomatic itching, loss of sensation, nerve spasms. So it's not uncalled for to say that pica could definitely have accompanied some of these symptoms in Salem. I definitely think it's one of the more believable things, because I think that growing up in a Puritan society, these girls would not be as prone to simply causing this chaos and condemning people for quote-unquote fun.
Yeah.
At least I don't want to say that, because that makes me even more sad. I would like to say that it is some semblance of, you know, their upbringing, what they're exposed to, you know, a manifestation of all of this stress, anxiety, social pressure that kind of surrounded them. So, I mean, again, as someone mentioned in one of the comments of this article, it's very hard to go back and diagnose history because we really don't have all the details. We don't necessarily know what happened. But I do think this is one of the more believable ones.
I definitely agree with you. I wonder if, and I mean, we don't really have the sources that would tell us this, right? We would have had to, you know, be there to see it. But I really wonder if there were any differences between the ways that the girls were acting. You know, they're sick, they're being looked after by doctors, everybody's very worried about them, that sort of thing. And then the way that they acted in the courtroom, where their symptoms seemed to appear and disappear at will, right? I wonder if it was a situation where they had this sort of somatoform thing happen to them. We know now it's like medical, mental illness type psychiatric cause, right? But at the time, you know, there's no understanding of that at all. And so I wonder if maybe the doctor says, oh, well, you girls were bewitched. And so they start getting better. And now they're sort of having to go along with that, right? Everyone around them in their lives is saying, well, when you were sick, you shouted these names out. It must be true. And eventually the girls just come to, because of their upbringing, they also believe that that is why they were sick. And so,
because it is a form of brainwashing.
Yeah. Like, and so, you know, even in the courtroom, I think it's definitely possible that there was some faking going on, but I think that maybe, like Ann Putnam said, there was no malicious intent. I wonder maybe if it was almost like, you know, little kids, they always think that they're going to get in trouble. And it may very well have been a thing of, well, if you don't do this, you're going to get in trouble. And that may not have been true, but it might be what they thought.
And also, these court situations were extremely intensive and stressful. So it's no wonder that if they did have PTSD or a somatoform disorder, it's a trigger. And these women were saying, these girls are just hysterical. They don't know what they're saying. They're children, blah, blah, blah. And that kind of derision, I don't know if it was quote-unquote derision, but that kind of derision in the way they've been treated their entire life, mm-hmm. as they're supposed to be seen and not heard. They're yeah. supposed to mind their own business. They're supposed to do what they're told. I wonder if that wouldn't have been a trigger or yeah. something that, you know.
It's like subconscious is just telling them, like, freedom. Mm-hmm. You know? You have the freedom to speak or be exactly. loud for once or something, you know?
Yeah.
I also do know that a lot of times you have hallucinations, and the hallucinations are scary, you don't just forget what you saw.
No, you don't.
I know that there is an instance of somebody who survived a really traumatic event and was actually in a coma for a while, a medically mm-hmm. induced coma for a while. And people always ask her now that she's recovered. They say, like, oh, well, did you see anything? Were you dreaming? What was going on inside your head while you were in that coma? And she basically kind of says, like, that she can't talk about it because it was really scary, mm-hmm. and it was like traumatizing.
And what if the whole time she was in the coma it was just that over and over and over and over yeah. and over again?
Yeah. And so. I have no doubt that, you know, if these girls were really having hallucinations, those hallucinations stayed with them, mm-hmm. and it probably wasn't until they were adults that they were able to separate themselves from, oh, okay, that wasn't real, mm-hmm. you know.
Or even then they probably were still able to,
scary.
They're still living in a community that believes that.
Yeah.
And not only that, but they have the PTSD of growing up in that community, or mm-hmm. the side effects of growing up in that community, plus okay. having gone through this entire traumatic event and accusing all these individuals, and then having to deal with that and grow with that and live with that burden on them for the rest of their life. So we're not trying to downplay what they did or in any yeah. way excuse what they did, but we're trying to explain that we can't necessarily be completely condemning yeah. of these girls, because
I think there was definitely an element of like a trauma response mm-hmm. going on.
And that's one of the sad parts of this as well, because, mm-hmm. you know, so many people in that community did die and they did suffer from this. But I also do wonder if the girls were the same. They yeah. still suffered from
it. I think they probably were. I feel like it's a situation where all of these people had grown up in this society, so all of them were traumatized, whether they realized it or not. You know, mm-hmm. like, whether they realized that they had bad memories or just didn't feel good about themselves or, you know, had anxiety or, like, whatever. Obviously, they wouldn't describe those things that way, but they still would have experienced those things. Mm-hmm. And they probably all experienced those kind of things to some extent, because they all had been abused.
And that, to them, probably was Satan. Mm-hmm. Like, those feelings, the yeah. things that they can't quantify, the things they don't understand mm-hmm. yet, that we didn't even have words for.
Yeah.
That was probably to them Satan.
Yeah.
Or the devil or demonic influence.
Yeah, and for sure. And, you know, I mean, I just know in general, like, you know, so many people today who grew up in extremely conservative religious homes or like churches or schools or anything like that, a lot of people will talk about, you know, how they had this just constant anxiety that they were doing something wrong mm-hmm. and this constant fear that they were going to go to hell. And that's such a part of what these people thought, too. Mm-hmm. You know, they always thought, I'm not going to be good enough to go to heaven, or mm-hmm. I don't want to enact God's rage. You know?
And it probably only got worse after all of this went down, too.
Yeah.
I hope that all the people who died from this event and all the people who were even affected by this event, they're resting in peace, and that they found some semblance of happiness in their afterlife, yeah. regardless of what they believe or what you guys believe. Mm-hmm. That's the goal for everyone, I think.
Yeah.
On to a little bit more fun, happier stuff.
Much happier. Much more happier. Depressing, I promise.
So tell me about Salem.
Yes. Okay. So Salem was so much fun. Definitely, I think this is a really good note to end on, because Salem is just completely the opposite now of what the Puritans would have wanted Salem to be. Today, it is the home of tons of people who call themselves witches. It's the home to people who practice pagan religions. It's home to Christians. It's home to Muslims. It's home to people who practice whatever faith. Mm-hmm. When you go into Salem, and in general, this whole part of Massachusetts, it was really awesome. There are Black Lives Matter signs everywhere, like on church doors and things like that. Pride flags. I mean, it was just such a liberal, open-minded place. And obviously, I don't live there, so I don't know if that's all a front or, you know, not, but I definitely got the vibe that it was authentic. And I hope that it is. Salem is just the complete opposite of what it was in the 1600s, which is really awesome because, like I said, the Puritans were super boring, and Salem today is so interesting and so much fun.
I just picture Puritan 1690s, gray and bleak and depressing, and then modern day Salem, just rainbows and sparkles.
Yeah, and like modern day Salem. It's so funny because when we were actually in Salem, it was this beautiful, gorgeous 80 degree sunny day, you know, perfect weather. And then we kind of went for 2 days. And the day that we went on the history tour, there was this really big thunderstorm. And so we were kind of like, oh no, it's going to get rained out, you know. But then literally we went into a museum, we came out, and it was like bright and sunny again.
Yay,
and we were
like, yay, that's awesome.
Great.
Although to be fair, I would love it to have a thunderstorm in Salem. Like just set the atmosphere. Like you and I love rain. We love rainy days.
Oh yeah, for sure. rainy days are the best to me. But, you know, it was just very the opposite of the way that I imagine Salem in the 1690s. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, the way that Salem actually changed so much, the way that it became sort of like a tourist attraction like it is today, the way that it got this sort of reputation as being this like open-minded place, is that in the 1960s, there was this TV show called Bewitched.
It's so good. I love
that
show.
It's such a great show. Yeah, my parents like it. My mom especially loves it.
My parents and I will watch it, and she'll be like drinking a martini while she's pregnant.
No.
They didn't know that then. They didn't know.
No. Yes. But yeah, so basically there was like a fire in their set. Mm-hmm. And so they were kind of like, oh dear, what do we do? This is going to set production back. And so somebody had the bright idea to do 2 episodes about Salem, Massachusetts, where the main characters kind of went home to their witchy ancestors, so to speak. So they go all the way to Salem, Massachusetts, and they film 2 episodes. The episodes are a really big hit, and this really creates a lot of interest in Salem that hadn't really been there before. You know, I think people probably knew about the witch trials, but it was the sort of place that only, like, big history nerds would go. Mm-hmm. So it's, like, the kind of place me and my dad would want to go, because my dad's a history teacher, I have a degree in history, but the rest of us wouldn't want to go to, you know? Just the weirdos.
I feel like it merged modernity with the historical aspects of it, which I'm so grateful for, because it's such an amazing place.
Yeah.
And so
and
cool.
Whenever that episode aired, it wasn't very long after that that the first witch shop opened in Salem. And I don't actually know what the name of the store was, but it opened very shortly after that, which is so cool. So, like, going back all the way to the 60s, Salem has had this really cool pagan witch community. And so when you go to Salem, there are just tons of witch shops everywhere. My favorite was called House Witch.
We follow them on Instagram.
Yeah, we do. They were just really cool. And something I really liked about them was, you know, if you're somebody who you're pagan or whatever, you have any sort of like spiritual beliefs, you like crystals or sage or whatever, then you may know that there are some issues with, you know, appropriating culture and things like that. And this particular store was very dedicated to making sure things were ethically sourced, to making sure that they were not selling products that shouldn't be used by white people, things like that. And that was really, really cool because it wasn't what I came across in some of the other stores that I went in.
Which is what we need more often in these type of communities, because in finding your spiritual path, it is so easy to kind of bulldoze over others.
Yeah.
Especially in a country that has a history of, as we talked about, colonization.
And yeah.
You said there's cute little bumper stickers and stuff too, like decolonize yourself.
Yes, and yes.
I love that.
I think it was a magnet, and so I didn't get to get one because I don't use magnets.
Oh, she got me the cutest.
Yeah, I did.
She got me the cutest
I
mug.
I can't remember where I bought that, like what the store was called, but
It's big, which I love because Caroline knows I love big cups of tea.
Yes.
And it's just so soothing. And it says, not all witches live in Salem.
Yes.
And
that's
I
like
adore
a,
it.
You see that all over the city. There's just witch merch everywhere. But yeah, that was super cute. I think I got that at like the very first store we went in. And I was just like, oh, Ara needs this.
I'm so happy.
But yeah, so because Salem has become kind of a tourist attraction, there's a lot of things there that are, I wouldn't really recommend them. Mm-hmm. They're just sort of, I don't want to call them tourist traps because I definitely think they're based in history more than a lot of tourist traps are, but they're just not as good as some of the other things you can do there.
A lot of commercialism.
Yeah, very commercialized. There are 2 museums in particular. One of them is called the Witch Dungeon Museum. We did not go there because based on the things I read about it, it was really touristy. Mm-hmm. And apparently they have live reenactments of the witch trials. I don't know. It was definitely not the kind of thing that I was interested in seeing. So we didn't go to that. We did go to the Witch Museum, not to be confused with the other one. They are separate things. And the Witch Museum was very cool. I definitely recommend it, especially if you are not a big nerd and you don't know tons about the witch trials already. if you do know a lot about the witch trials already, you probably will already know everything that they tell you. For the first half of it, you go in and they have, basically you went into this sort of auditorium, and on sort of the walls above you, there were these little rooms that were open, and the presentation would start and the spotlights would shine on each room as the story progressed, you know, to tell the story.
Kind of like Carousel of Progress, Disney
style.
Yeah,
very much, but it was interesting. It had a lot of information. It did a really good job of summarizing the whole event, much better than we did.
Don't give it too much credit, Caroline.
I know.
Caroline and I work there on our off days. So.
Secretly, even though we don't live in Massachusetts.
Nowhere near there, but.
Hundreds of miles away.
We fly by our brooms.
Yeah, we do. Or we turn into birds or bats or whatever the witches did.
Who knows? Yeah. Whatever we're feeling like that day.
Whatever we felt like. And then the second part actually was quite interesting. After you kind of go through that presentation, you go into another room where they kind of give another one. And this one is more on modern day depictions of witches. So they talk about like witches in Hollywood. Like they talk about Bewitched. They talk about The Wizard of Oz. They talk about
Hocus Pocus.
Hocus Pocus is everywhere in Salem because they filmed.
Caroline's wearing
of it there.
Her Hocus Pocus
I am. Amok, amok, amok.
I love it.
But yeah, it talks about that. And then they talk about like modern day witchcraft. Or actually, I think they only talked about Wicca.
Which is not to be confused with witchcraft, because Wicca is its own religion.
Yeah.
And it's often confused with witchcraft.
It's just a separate, like, paganism.
Yeah. Witchcraft is just, you can use it religiously, you can use it spiritually,
yeah, there are a lot
you
of people
use it
who,
secularly.
There are a lot of, like, Christians who practice various forms of witchcraft, quote-unquote.
Mm-hmm. You
know. I would imagine most of us know somebody who regularly, like, smudges sage or has crystals or anything like that, and it's all kind of in that category. So they did that, and then they actually, and I thought this was really important, they have this whole wall that talks about how just sort of the, you know, mass hysteria that was behind the witch trials, the way that these sort of extreme beliefs can lead to mass murder, you know, in sort of an execution style or, you know, mass arrests or just mass vilification of people continues to happen today. They talked about like McCarthyism. I think they talked about something else too, but I don't remember what. But that's the main one I remember because history nerd. I think I would have enjoyed it more if it was more of a traditional museum, you know, where you weren't having the story told to you, but you got to kind of go at your own pace and stuff like that. But that's just my opinion. I definitely recommend that museum. It was good. And I think it was like, it wasn't super expensive. So I don't remember how much it was, but it wasn't expensive. Another thing is that if you are ever doing like, you know, research on the Salem Witch Trials or anything like that for school or whatever, definitely use the Witch Museum's website. They have so much information on there. I read a lot of stuff on there before, like, writing our script out. So it was really helpful.
And you had an amazing tour.
Yeah. So the other thing that is going on in Salem everywhere is there are walking tours. You have ghost tours. You have history tours. You have combinations of both. And I love going on ghost tours on vacations because I love spooky stuff. So I definitely wanted to go on one. And we signed up for this one that had really, really fantastic reviews. It was called the History and Hauntings Tour with Witch City Walking Tours. And our tour guide was this guy named Sam Jones. He's a graduate student in history at Harvard. He was definitely like a skeptic. So the tour was a little bit less, you know, hauntings based as I was expecting. But nevertheless, the tour was super awesome. I feel like I learned more than I did anywhere else in Salem on that tour. You know, so much of what we talked about was stuff that I just shot off from memory of that tour. It was really, really good, and I can't recommend it enough. It was just so good. So if you do go to Salem, I highly recommend Witch City Walking Tours. They have quite a few different ones, so, you know, just pick the one you want. I think they all are probably really, really good quality. And I just think it's important to say that because it's so easy when you go to cities that are sort of notoriously haunted or spooky to be like, oh, that tour sounds really good. It sounds scary. And then you get on it and it's not. It's just silly.
Yeah.
And so, you know, you definitely want to try to get one that is informative and not just, what's the word I'm looking for? Yeah, cheesy or just being like, and then there was a ghost. It's like, there wasn't a ghost, okay? We are not stupid. There was no ghost. You didn't see a ghost, okay? So yeah, there was that. Another thing that I really recommend is the Witch House, not to be confused with the Witch Museum. So the Witch House is the only structure in Salem that's still standing from the 1600s that is directly connected to the Salem Witch Trials. There's a couple of structures in Salem that were standing in the 1600s that are just totally unrelated to the witch trials, but this one has direct connection. Judge Jonathan Corwin lived there. He was the original resident. You can tour the house and see what it would have looked like inside at the time that he lived there, kind of see, you know, how his family would have lived and everything. When you go upstairs in the witch house, they have a kind of a display of like all of this strange things that the Puritans and probably other people too in this time period would have done in order to prevent sickness. And it was like all based on superstitions. Like one of them is this thing called corpse moss or skull moss or something like that. Do you know what I'm talking about?
I think so.
Basically, they believe that it only worked if you did this on the skull of somebody who had been executed for a crime, so a criminal. You know, you hang this person and then they are left hanging there to decay. Mm-hmm. And eventually moss will start growing on their skull. And so then they would take that moss and eat it to cure sicknesses and stuff.
Are they sure it's moss and not mold?
I think it's probably mold, but they called it moss.
I mean, so it's very similar to in Europe, I believe, they would also do something like that, uh-huh, where they would actually catch the blood from
people. They talked about that too.
Or you know, their flesh or something, mm-hmm, and eat it. And I was like,
y'all are cannibals. This is weird.
I was like, y'all gonna condemn people for doing witchcraft, but you're gonna eat other people?
Yeah, you, okay, you're drinking blood over there, you little vampire. Yeah, I definitely recommend the witch house. Also, the witch house is really pretty on the outside.
It's so aesthetic. It's
Caroline
and I. All right,
and I
want to
live there.
Exactly. We want to buy it. We have nowhere near the amount of money, and also it's a historical landmark, probably. So.
Yes, it definitely is. The reason it's called the witch house actually has very little to do with anything that happened there. Basically, the house had kind of fallen into disrepair, and then this pharmacist bought it, and he was going to turn it into his pharmacy, and he was trying to come up with, like, a memorable name for it, and he knew that it was kind of the only structure left that was associated with the witch trials, so he just started calling it the witch house, and the name stuck, and that's what it's been ever since.
Did he ever use it as a pharmacy?
I think so.
It's really cool if he was doing herbal, you know, herbal remedies.
Yeah, herbal remedies.
That it would be, like, associated back with the witchcraft of the day.
So, yeah, that's Salem. I definitely also think Salem is, like, just cute. There's a lot of really good food there. We had some really good desserts and stuff. We had really good food every single time we ate there.
How many witch cakes?
Definitely no witch cakes. Definitely no witch cakes. Lots of ice cream. We had ice cream, like, 2 or 3 times, but
that sounds good, especially on, like, 80-degree days.
Yeah, it was perfect. There's a lot of, like, cute shops to walk around to. There's a mall there, but don't go in it. It's really creepy. And not the good kind of creepy.
Oh.
The sad kind of creepy.
Oh, okay.
Yeah, very sad.
I was like, it's creepy. We'd love that.
No, not the good
kind.
Not
our kind of creepy.
The creepy that's like, somehow I don't think this has been de-COVIDized, you know? Like, I feel like...
Oh, okay.
You know what I mean? Like, I don't want to touch that. I feel like I'm going to get... Yeah.
Yeah.
I don't know. I don't mean to speak badly about anything in Salem. I don't live there. Maybe it's not as bad as it seemed for me when I, like, walked in the door to find the bathroom, but... It seemed
you gotta
suspicious.
Go with your intuition.
Yeah. And for the record, there's a place like that in my hometown, so
we all have places in that.
I understand, you know.
Especially if you're in the South with these new mask mandates and everyone being like, I'm not putting them back on.
Yeah, that was a really nice thing in Massachusetts and, like, in general in New England. My dad is so funny. He loves to just talk to strangers. And so he just randomly would go up to somebody and start talking to them. And then suddenly my mom and I from across the room would hear him go, have y'all been vaccinated?
Okay, at least that's vaguely normal. I was at my I was at the psychiatrist's office the other day, and literally this woman, just to the entire room of people waiting, she was like, have y'all been vaccinated? But it wasn't a good thing, because she was like, well, the FDA hasn't approved it, and she started going off. But there was another lady who was very pro-vaccine,
in, like,
so she kind of took her to task. Yeah.
Good.
So I was just sitting there, like, on my phone,
just
trying,
like,
to keep my mouth shut.
This other lady.
Because my parents were always like, mind your business.
Yeah, mine are too. And my dad and I both, well, I don't do it as much anymore, but my dad, he's very outspoken on Facebook, you know, so he's always, like, combating these people who say stupid stuff.
I was like, this is not
my
a good mood setter for me going into my appointment.
Yeah.
I was like, there's a reason she's at the psychiatric office.
Yeah. But yeah, so he would just go up and ask people if they were vaccinated. But the thing is that literally every single person we talked to was. And so we were so relieved.
Which is honestly
so nice.
Should not be as rare as it is here.
I know. It was really funny because we went to Cape Cod one day, but we couldn't go to all the places we wanted because there is an outbreak of the Delta variant in Cape Cod. And so we were kind of like, let's not go that far.
Yeah.
We don't want to be in that. So we avoided it. But if you look at the like map of the Delta variant, like where it's the worst, it's pretty much terrible everywhere except for most of New England. In New England, it's fine.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And I'm like, well, that's because they all got vaccinated. And they have herd immunity.
Get vaccinated, folks.
Please get vaccinated.
Daily reminder.
Please, 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 please.
If you guys need information, facts, or anything like that, I'd be happy to. Same. I know a bunch of virologists that are at Princeton that they love to talk to people about this.
Yeah,
they'd
it's literally
love
their
to,
job.
Yeah, they'd love to, you know, let you guys know about the facts, about the benefits that outweigh any cons you could come up with. So, yeah, get vaccinated.
Please.
Because we don't want another mass hysteria moment.
No. Alrighty.
Make sure you follow us on Facebook. We have both a page that you can like and follow, as well as a group that we'd love you to join. The group
Please
is
join.
Private, so no one else will see if you're in the group or not, what we're discussing. So, you know, if you listen to this and your grandma might not approve of it, you'll be fine.
Yeah.
Also, we have a Twitter, which is at Wicked Weird Grim. Our Facebook and our Instagram are both at Wicked Weird and Grim. And we also have a Patreon, so if you guys like our content and would like to support us and continue to make more content, we'd love it for you guys to visit our Patreon there. We also have our website, which is linked in most of our subscriptions.
Yeah, pretty much everything.
And we'd love if you would 5-star us on iTunes.
Please.
Please leave us a review.
Yes.
Let us know how we're doing. We're so glad that you guys are listening.
We are. We just want to hear from you.
We had a lot more plays and listens than I thought we would on our first episode.
Yeah.
So thank you guys so much for supporting us. And we have the best weirdos with us.
Yeah, for real.
I want to call the people who listen to us our weirdos.
Our weirdos.
Weirdos. Oh. Our weirdos who listen to the Grim Sisters on Wicked Weird Wednesdays.
Maybe they're like our Grim Ghouls.
Aww.
Our ghoulies. Aww.
That's cute. Our little feet. We need to come up with cute
That only makes sense if you listen to the previous episode.
Go listen to episode 1. And please know our audio has immensely improved.
We hope.
Fingers crossed. Editing Aura.
Yes.
Please confirm this.
Yes. And we'll hopefully continue to improve as we go on. And
definitely.
I remember to speak into the microphone because...
And I remember not to say exactly every 5 minutes because my dad can only take so many shots.
Your dad's gonna...
I know.
Have to take a lot of shots. Oh, dear. Ara's dad takes shots every time she says exactly.
And let me tell you, the first episode, woo! I'm trying to do better, guys. I'm trying to do better. Although maybe I should start saying it more just because of that.
There's a limit even for Slavic men.
Besides that, thank you guys so much for listening. We had
thank
so much
you.
Fun. And tune in for our episode next week on Wicked Weird Wednesdays.
Yep.
And we will see you then.
Woohoo.
Bye.
Bye. I waved at them again.
Carla.
It's going to be me every week. I waved at them again.
It's okay. It might just come to be your thing.
Yeah. Because last week it was Into the Thick of It.
Which I included in the bloopers.
I know. Born in 1964,
Jeffrey Bezos.
But you know what's bad is that every time I find myself singing along, I want to say Jeffrey Epstein instead of Jeffrey Bezos.
No.
I'm just like, no, that's not it. That's not
that's
it.
That's for another episode. We will talk
that's
about.
That's not it.
Jeffrey Epstein got murdered. That's one conspiracy theory I will ascribe to.
I mean,
I'm definitely thinking
the funniest thing was like, in the midst of all of the, like, political turmoil in the United States where everybody just hates each other for, you know, reasons and nobody can agree on anything, we all agree, for one reason or another, that Jeffrey Epstein was murdered.
Mm-hmm.
Like, everybody just agrees on that.
Yep.
It's just universal.
Jeffrey Bezos. The fact that Jeffrey Bezos is an alumni of Princeton.
Really?
So I'm associated with him. I'm like...
It's very, like, six
but
degrees
at the same
of separation.
Time, I'm also like, you want to hire a fellow alumni of Princeton?
not to work in the factory shipping place.
Yeah. Let me work in the high ups.
Yeah.
And then slowly
work in the office.
I'll unsettle everything and, you know, give Amazon workers a livable wage.
I love that his ex-wife, she's just like, yeah, I'm going to give all my money away.
I love her.
Me too.
She was like, great. I'm going to take all of this money that you have and donate all of it, and yeah, then go live on a farm with my new boyfriend.
I love her. And I was like, I want to be her when I grow up.
Literally, I was like, you're my role model. You are the person that I've always aspired to be.
A blooper.
It sounds like Shakira.
It reminds me of the guy. Aren't you glad your name isn't Cotton or Increase?
It's just so, I don't know why. They're like, what's a good
Increase?
Increase.
What's your name? I'm Increase. John. What's yours? Increase.
I increase the hysteria at Salem Witch Trials.
Look at that. I'm telling you, bodily noises over here. I don't know what's going on.
Your body is like, I am protesting.
Yeah, my body's rejecting podcasting.
Your body said no. So.
What in the world?
Pootiator.
Pootiator? Sounds like poo.
Pootiator.
Sounds like radiator.
It's just going to be poo. It's just going to be in every episode of ours. We can't escape him.
Yeah, I feel like Putin is the kind of person that would support witch trials. Like,
I could see it.
Yeah.
Although I could also see, him being the witch and then supporting the witch trials. Yeah. So.
Very, very insidious.
Oh, Putin.
And.
Pootiator.
Pootiator. Pootiator.
I'll look Pootiator? It up. Pootiator.
I just don't know how to pronounce that. Like, oh my gosh. We got through all those Russian, weird Russian, like, hard-to-pronounce names last week, and then this word.
Okay, the Wikipedia literally says one of the things she was accused of was causing a man to fall out of a tree.
Oh.
And then...
Go, girl.
I know, I was like, what?
I guess, I don't know. I hope we deserve
another
it.
One was having witchcraft materials in her home, which she claimed was grease for making soap. Then turning herself into a bird and flying into her house.
I'm gonna turn myself into a bird and fly into my house.
We all do. We all want the option.
Oh my gosh, my foot's asleep. It's super, super asleep. Like, I can't feel anything. Like, my foot fell out of my shoe and I literally can't. Like, I think a witch attacked my foot.
Caroline's like, my foot is being suffered by a spectral ghost.
Okay, we're good now. She woke up. We're fine.
It is pins and needles.
Douche says we have good podcast voices and sound professional.
Thanks, Sooge. I don't believe you, but...
No, I think we sound questionable, but hey, we try. When... Why are we like this?
And you stay down low when you go to the phone.
Oh my
god.
Up
and out of the night, kind of Joe. I've been married a long time ago. Where'd you come from? Where'd you go? Where'd you come from? Kind of Joe.